Well, guess what? Somebody that just kind of sold off on their secondary, they've got an empty bucket. So it's constantly rotating through a cycle of lenders who are competitive, extremely efficient, and looking for the business. And only a mortgage broker is going to be able to assess that in that moment in time, whether you're buying today or you're looking tomorrow.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. I'm here with Ryan Gibson. How you doing, Ryan?
Tate, always good to see you and always good to talk debt, because that is what it's all about right now. Hard to get debt.
That's right.
That's expensive. And I'm looking forward to the show.
I have been looking forward to talking to David for months. Really, before we even launched the show, this was on my radar. We're going to talk mostly about residential today. David Temko serves as the president and CEO of C2 Financial, which is America's largest mortgage broker platform, currently operating in 30 states and employing approximately 1,000 loan originators. He's got a background in the mortgage industry. They do all types of loans. And we're actually going to have him back on in a future episode to talk about the differences between primary residence, second home, commercial, investment, all that sort of stuff. But for today, we talked a lot about interest rates and the home buying process. I think people will get a ton out of it.
Yeah, the framing here, I think, is like, do I buy a house right now with interest rates just going up 0.25%, but the Fed at the Fed funds rate at 5.5%? Does it make sense? Should I wait? Should I hang out on the sidelines? And who do I call? Who is the expert that I call to get a residential mortgage or a commercial mortgage from? And that's why we brought David onto the show to answer all these questions. And with that, let's get right into it.
Let's go. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. We appreciate having you.
Absolutely. Great to be here, Tate.
What a time to be talking about mortgage rates and home buying and everything. Really excited to have you on as well, David. I guess we'll kick us off and just say, what the heck's going on out there today? I mean, mortgage rates are up. Home sales seem to be slowing. I don't know. Maybe they're staying the same. Maybe there's just less inventory. What are you seeing?
Great question, Ryan. My toast to the last holiday party is rates are up, but we can still get down. So, I mean, we're out here doing what we can, find an opportunity in every market. And that's really what it comes down to. There's definitely less inventory. Folks are sitting on their homes because it's an asset to have, you know, an interest rate or a mortgage with an interest rate at 1%, 2%, 3% in the front of it. So unless something really, you know, happens in their life, death, divorce, dissolution, or something disruptive, they're really looking hard in the mirror, depending on, you know, to determine whether they're going to move somewhere or not. And they're probably going to stay put for quite some time. And if they want to stay there and there's things that need to be changed, they're going to use some equity in their home and renovate it and stay there until, like I said, something changes and they need to move.
Do you see more sales in new construction homes or existing? What are you seeing there?
Well, I saw the CEO of, was it Lennar or Toll Brothers, come on. And yeah, they're trying to catch up for 15 years of under development and under building. I'm based out of San Diego. It's a pretty established market, like most cities across the West Coast or, you know, other metropolitan areas. And that's just a lot of infill. So I think that the new development is going to be in more affordable markets where there's more land. But generally, you know, the markets, the larger metropolitan markets are going to be much more infill. So it's really, you know, pulling together plots of land, you know, lots, and then doing a subdivision. So I see that, but I think generally the majority of the sales are existing homes.
Interesting. Well, before we get into, you know, all of this stuff, let's talk quickly about your background. How'd you get into the mortgage industry? And can you give us some history on maybe the industry and then as a little more specifics on C2?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the business. My pops was an entrepreneur and got into commercial real estate, did commercial real estate leasing for quite some time, and eventually got out of that and found his way, did some appraisal business, but got into residential mortgage, and was kind of an Excel guru and took what was kind of an archaic way of taking a loan application, you know, on carbon copy paper, and transitioned into that, doing that in Excel, and then hit the road and really sold that platform, brought people onto his brokerage at a, you know, at a high split margin, and gave away that technology. And that was the genesis of a high split mortgage brokerage shop, and grew that, you know, all the way through, you know, through the years of when I was young in college, coming home, interning for top producers. So it was really always around the dinner table, the language. I was kind of shown some of the ropes by top producers that, you know, worked at our company and, you know, visited them. So, you know, kind of got the origination side, kind of got the compliance side. And I graduated college in 2007, which was an interesting market to come into. And I'll never forget going out with my dad and his buddies. It was the Tuesday Night Out crew. They're all, you know, successful guys, whether it was real estate, you know, investing or finance or doctors, attorneys, whatever it was. They were kind of my board of directors. And I'll never forget kind of seeing my pops kind of almost pulling his hair out because the market had imploded. And his best friend, a guy I grew up with, hunting and fishing with, that I looked up to greatly, was a big commercial real estate investor. And he was just kind of steady Eddie, cool as a cucumber. Hey, I'll have another beer. And I recognized in that moment that that was an opportunity for me to go into that. And I left the family business of being in, you know, residential mortgage brokerage. And I signed up in commercial brokerage, doing sales, and cut my teeth, you know, real boiler room type situation, and just making, you know, 60 to 120 calls a day, and trying to cut my teeth on that. And it evolved into me actually getting into the capital market side, doing commercial loan brokerage. And I really felt that that was a really good happy medium, that axis of having the residential mortgage background, wanting to be on the investment side and learning that acumen on the commercial side, and doing commercial loan brokerage was just a perfect fit for me. Granted, I was making, you know, 25 basis points straight commission. So
right.
Fortunately, my overhead was super low. So all I needed was some beer money in those times. And but it was good. And that's kind of how I got into commercial loan brokerage, eventually got recruited out, did commercial banking. But my involvement in our family's company drove me back to them and to the organization, and building a commercial mortgage brokerage platform at C2 Financial was a really good opportunity, because it allowed our, you know, the breadth of our business has always been residential mortgage brokerage, but the decision people make when buying a home is often one of the largest they're ever going to make. And the loan officers that we have that steward that experience and that capital can be so much more for their clients. They really are a full financial and real estate resource. And so oftentimes when a borrower gets a loan from a mortgage broker at C2 and they do a great job, they come back and they say, hey, you knocked another park on my home loan, getting me in there. I want to buy an investment property, a commercial building, or, you know, whether it's for an investment because it generates income, or it's they have a business and they want to buy a property for their business. And in the past, that individual would say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. And then it kind of gets out of their, I don't know if it's their sphere of influence or, you know, but that person finds a yes person and then they're out. And so my goal at C2 is really to, in the C2 orbit, have our loan officers, you know, truly be that financial and real estate resource, whether it's forward mortgage, whether it's reverse mortgage, whether it's commercial mortgage, or there's a sales component. And that's really what I drive to do, to grow the company and, you know, attract talent all over that can do that.
That's great. And, you know, you mentioned like attracting talent and kind of building a business. How, contrast that to, you know, kind of your first few mortgages that you did maybe on your own, to how you've really scaled. I'm always interested in that side of things, because as a real estate investor, I was always like really focused on the real estate investing. And then we grew to over 130 employees. And now it's like there's a lot of leadership that goes into kind of handling that. You know, kind of talk about your team and sort of what's your day-to-day like today?
Yeah. I mean, the first loan your first part of that question, you know, the first loans that I've done, it's like, you know what you know, and you know, you kind of don't know a lot. So you're kind of taking all your experience and looking to expand on that through each transaction, through each opportunity. You always learn stuff from. And that's why you kind of lean on, you know, specialists that have that experience that you don't. So, I mean, sure, the first couple loans I did when I was, you know, in brokerage or in banking were rough for me, were probably rough for the client, but, you know, you know, keep your head down and you power through and you continue to deliver a good experience. And for us, there's a lot of folks out there that, you know, have come from different places and how they land at C2. And it's about finding folks that are really good at what they're, you know, what they're the best at. And a lot of times people are really good at doing loans or really good at finding investment properties, but there's a lot of things that surround that that they're not good at, that they don't want to do. And so at C2, we basically take all the stuff that they don't want to do off their plate, and that's legal, licensing, compliance. So we have a platform where loan officers can really just focus on what they're the best at, which is finding borrowers and making sure and placing them with the best financing that's the most conducive for whatever their financial need is, depending on what the property is they're buying and their kind of, you know, nuances with their own finances that generate income. So, but yeah, that just takes time.
Well, I certainly can plug you guys because I, you know, came across you by using one of your officers who was fantastic, and I got a really great refinance on my place. But I'd like to switch gears to, you know, the industry, to interest rates. You know, a lot of people, I hear this on a weekly basis that I'm waiting for the crash. I'm waiting for prices to come down. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on interest rates, where interest rates are going? Sort of where are we in terms of the market? Because you probably have your finger on the pulse just as well as anyone.
Yeah. If you're waiting, so is everybody else. So, right. You know, it's like, oh, everybody's, you know, when rates come down, I'm going to be in the market. Well, you and everybody else that's, you know, sitting on the sidelines. And I think if you have the ability or you have the affordability to buy, or the acumen and the ability to buy a property now, you're going to be in a better position than somebody that's waiting for rates to come down. Because when rates come down, you can refinance and you're right. In a better, you know, you're in a great spot because you bought it while rates were high, maybe values were either relatively stable or have come down, versus when rates come back down and then, you know, prices spike again because there's a huge demand back in the market. So I think if you're sitting on the sidelines and you're paying rent, well, I think you should do kind of a cost analysis on what you can write off in terms of the interest, you know, compared to the entire monthly payment. You know, there's some tax benefits. And so you can reverse engineer, you know, okay, I'm paying this much in rent, but it's just to, you know, to sleep and eat here. And I'm not building any equity, versus what I can buy. And maybe there's a premium to that, but I can, there could be upside in terms of, you know, appreciation. I can write off my interest. So there's a lot of benefits and pride of ownership. So, and plus where you want to, you know, set some roots down. I mean, where people are at in their life. It might not mean they need a house and because they're living in an apartment. Maybe it's an opportunity to buy a 2-unit, a 3-unit, a 4-unit, get, you know, residential financing. And that's an opportunity to get in your first investment property. It doesn't change your life, your lifestyle that much. It doesn't increase from a cost perspective, from a space perspective. So it's really assessing what you need, what you're comfortable with, and seeing what calculated risks you can take that fit into your life in that moment.
And what do you have, like a tool that people use or a website that would go and kind of help analyze those types of decision making on, you know, rent versus buy, how much am I spending? Do you have any like online calculators or do you just use kind of just like general amortization calculators or things like that?
To be honest, I do have something that I've created on the commercial side that was really for an owner user that's renting a space. You know, my corporate office is 7,500 square feet here in San Diego, and I ran that exercise because my lease is rolling in October. And I was like, you know, so I kind of went through that rigmarole and I can see kind of, okay, what my rent is, you know, what my down, you know, relative to a down payment and what my monthly payment is and how that shakes out, you know, with, and I mean, you can make any spreadsheet look amazing, but I try to be relatively conservative with appreciation and maybe put like 1% versus like a 3%, you know, 1% appreciation over the course of, you know, a year. And it'll tell you, you know, how much wealth you're going to build, how much equity you're going to gain over that. And so I have something like that and we use that on the commercial, in the commercial division that I have a gentleman running for me and for our company. On the residential side, that would be something I'd lean on, you know, one of the thousand, you know, amazing loan officers that we have that focus on that. They're going to probably be have the acumen to help someone like that. And if somebody's looking at C2, there's, you know, the loan officers that are with us are, you know, the best in the business. They've been around for the longest. They're seasoned veterans, and they can definitely help guide that process in terms of helping a potential buyer understand, you know, the benefits of homeownership compared to where they're currently at renting.
I got a question for you. So, you know, one of the terms that I've heard thrown around, which I actually really agree with, is you marry the property and you date the rate, right? It's like, you know, you can always refinance if interest rates come down and you lock in the, you know, the price today, because as you alluded to, you know, this is not 2008. People have a ton of equity in their homes. There's the rate lock effect where there's restricted inventory because there's so many mortgages sub 4%, 3% interest. And so nobody wants to sell. And there's also a supply shortage, which was the complete opposite in 2008. So I'm with you in that we're at a completely different time in history right now. So if someone wants to buy today and refinance later, can you sort of walk through a description of that process for someone who's never done a refinance before, maybe some risks and what that process looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to me how ingrained it is in people's minds to get a 30-year fixed. And if you look back historically, you know, if you look at a chart, you know, a 7-year fixed, a 7-year ARM is always going to win in the long term. And generally people's lives change and they're not going to be, I just don't know that many people that have actually got one loan fixed for 30 years and 30 years later they paid off and that was the only loan they've ever had. You know, it's just, right. It's unheard of. So that's a situation, you know, unlike a, you know, a husband or a wife that you are married to and you have a 30-year anniversary. I mean, that's a totally different program. You know, there's probably a lot more happy marriages out here than 30 mortgages that actually went to the finish line.
Yeah.
But I think, like you said, if you love the house, then get, you know, the rate and the terms that fit the, you know, your strategy in that moment. I think that we're all kind of, you know, optimistically thinking that rates are going to come down sometime middle of next year. You know, with the way the Fed is operating, they really only have one dial, which is raising the Fed funds rate. And we're probably anticipating another two pops on that just because they're, you know, that's their job and that's what they're trying to do. And that's their plan. We can get, Yeah, exactly. A lot of data going into that. But if you like the home and it fits, like it fits your lifestyle, then get into it. You know, whether it's a 5 or a 7 year or a 10 year, the 10 year treasuries, the 10 year fix actually trade. There's a larger market for that. So generally, the 10-year fix is going to command a lower rate than a 5 or a 7 would, which is interesting. I just recently bought a house and I did a 10-year fixed, you know, and I'm going to, you know, get in there, fix it up, live in it, make it comfortable for me where I'm at in my life. And then when rates come down, I will be in the market refinance. So I'm dating that rate.
There we go.
The big theme is refinancing, right? Like buy the house, date the rate, marry the house, et cetera. What risks do we have in that? And you know what kind of processes would you be following, or what are your thoughts on, you know, sort of the so what there in the future?
Great question. I mean, the risk is that rates just keep going up, you know, and that's I just don't see that being the case. I think a healthy market is rates in the 4s and the 5s. You know, I think that's a real healthy market. I think, you know, we're just trying to recover from the historically low interest rates are probably out there for too long. You know, rates in the 2s and the 3s are just the low. I don't think we'll see that for ever or very, very, very long time, unless something extremely catastrophic happens and they have to do it to spur the market all over again. I mean, I think we're kind of seeing this rise. We're going to get another two pops. Unfortunately, it's sad to think that they have to, you know, really knock down the job market in order for inflation to come down.
Yeah, wages.
Honestly, I don't agree with that. I think it's really a productivity factor. I think it's really getting people to work and working hard and using the money in the market through trade, through, you know, through that production versus rising interest rates, raising interest rates and knocking jobs down and people going, oh shit, I don't have a job. I got to, you know, focus on my savings and spend a lot less for, you know, inflation to come down. I don't really like that approach, but like I said, that's really the only approach that the Fed has. And that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that it's, you know, the Fed only has one tool. You know, all they can do is throw cold water on demand. They can't spur productivity. That has to come from Congress, basically. And then it takes time.
The other thing that I think is interesting, like, so I bought my first house in 2009. Great time to buy, September 2009, right at the bottom. And I think my first interest rate was like 5.5. And then I didn't know anything about refinancing or what it was, or I was really ignorant to the whole process. And rates dropped to like 4.5. And then I was like, oh man, I should probably refinance, right? Right? Does that make sense? And then they dropped like again. And I think I ended up refinancing my house like 4 times or something in like the course of like 5 years. Is there any like rule of thumb that you have? Like how much should interest rates drop, or what is your thought process there? Like what are people waiting for to like spring into action on a refi?
Well, there is costs associated to refinancing. I mean, there's definitely some thirds, you know, you have title, escrow, appraisal, you know, so there is costs associated to it. So, but if you look at that compared to where your rate was and where you're dropping your, you know, your rate to and your monthly payment to, you can quickly assess how quickly you're going to capture the cost of refinancing it. So, I mean, you refinancing that many times over the course of 5 years, it makes sense. If you did it like that many times in 1 year, then I don't think it's going to make sense. And you're going to kind of irritate a loan officer because there's some components of that really can have some repercussion.
I don't know how many times it actually was, but it felt a lot. Like at one point my wife was like, does this even make sense? Because it costs money to do it every time, right? And I think I ended up going all the way down to like 3%, right? And so like, or 3.125% or something like that. I was trying to figure out like, is it one full point? Is that kind of the heuristic, or is it a half point, or I don't know. Is that a way to think about it, or something else?
I think a full point to drop is pretty significant. I think if it's, you know, in between that 50 basis points to 100 basis points, that, you know, half a point to a point, then you're probably right in the strike zone and it's worth it. But like I said, you can look on a regular amortization calculator going, hey, this is what my loan amount, this is my monthly payment now. You can look at what your principal balance is in that moment, you know, based on your most recent mortgage statement, and go, okay, well, you probably haven't paid down that much principal in the first 5 years, but maybe you have, you know, maybe thrown a little bit more at it, or maybe something happened in your life where you have a larger liquidity event. You go, you know what, I want to work on paying this down. I've got $1 million loan. I want to knock it down to 900,000. Interest rates are lower. You know, I want to do that. But then there's something to consider on that is, you know, maybe I keep my interest rate or keep my loan at $1 million and drop my interest rate. And I use that $100,000 to go invest in, you know, in some type, you know, where I can get better arbitrage. You know, my money's better spent. And that's where, you know, you look to somebody like Tate and you as well, like whether it's apartments or storage facilities and something like that. So a lot of stuff to consider there too.
Yeah. So I want to skip ahead to a question that I was going to get to, which is HELOCs and sort of accessing lazy equity in homes and rental properties through refinance. And one of the points I want to kind of make here is that you can go both ways. So you can either refinance and take money out by taking a larger loan, mm-hmm. or you can put money in, you can come to the closing table, which is actually what happened with my last refinance. I came in with about $20,000 to bring it under the conforming rate, under the conforming limit, which allowed me to get about an additional 50 basis points off my rate. So anyway, but when we're talking about pulling money out, can you kind of talk to that in terms of what that lazy equity means? If you have a bunch of equity sitting in your home that isn't really doing anything for you, and sort of using that to arbitrage?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that there is opportunity to take advantage of HELOCs or standalone seconds. And that's really, first and foremost, it's a function of what other revolving debt people have.
Right.
You know, if they have, and that often from a loan officer standpoint can be easily addressed from a credit report. If somebody has outstanding revolving credit card debt, that's in the, you know, there's a two handle in front of that. There's like a 20 plus percent interest rate on something like that. So consolidating that debt in something that's going to be, you know, maybe 10+% between 10 and 12% is generally where you see in seconds a lot of times can be a huge reduction of cost in terms of interest being paid on that. So that's definitely a good utilization of financing to consolidate debt with equity you have. But to utilize the equity that they have, that lazy equity, I mean, there has been a lot of appreciation. It depends on how long someone's been in that home. If they've been in that home for quite some time and they want to utilize that equity and they have opportunities to put it to work, you know, it just depends on where can they put it to work and like where that positive arbitrage is going to be, you know, and or, you know, what's happening in their life. They got kids that are going to school. They got, you know, whatever it is, if they need to utilize that, I mean, there's no question about it. They can. And it can be a good source of capital. And it's just kind of, you know, they've earned it. So they can definitely.
Yeah. Hot tip on this conversation. You know, we bought a bunch of self-storage over the last, 5 or 6 years. And we got great first mortgages on the properties, you know, low interest rates, you know, 3 to 7.5 to 4.5, something like that. And part of the business plan was to eventually expand the property, so put on additional units. And what's really neat is that you can actually go back to the same lender that lent you the first mortgage, and they essentially look at your expansion plans, and instead of rewriting the entire mortgage and wiping out that really great first at, you know, 4.25% or 4%, they'll do a bolt-on loan that's separate. It's like a second position, kind of like a HELOC almost, where that interest rate is higher, but the blended interest rate on the two loans is still really attractive. So I know, Tate, you're in a few deals of ours like that, where we've done that, where we've actually expanded the property and gone back to the same lender to get the construction expansion loan, because we didn't have our plans completely dialed in at the time of acquisition. That's why we wouldn't have gotten it then. So we've dialed in construction budgets and everything much later, because we got our permits done and now we're approved to start construction. Now the bank is ready to release the funds, but now the interest rates are, you know, are 2% higher. So we're getting that 6%, 6.5% second, but the blended rate is really good. So think about that in your home, right? Because you got that first position that's really, really low. And even if you get a HELOC that's higher, although it's going to be pretty high right now, that blended rate is still pretty attractive, especially in today's time. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Ryan, I got to say, the storage facility product, you know, I love that product. The tenants, they just don't talk that. I mean, you don't have any problems with them, really. They don't even use the bathroom.
There are no bathrooms sometimes.
Exactly. They just sit there. It's like
the best.
And they're sticky. Yeah. Fun fact: the average tenancy for a self storage unit is longer than multifamily.
Is it really? Okay.
That's
love it.
Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you not know that, Ryan?
You know, years ago, someone asked me that question, obviously, and I did a study, and I like went online and pulled all this data, and it was inconclusive. I couldn't find. And so I just say it's all about the same. Our average portfolio stay for storage is about 28 months. I don't know what it is for multifamily, but I couldn't find like an exact study done by.
The average is about 15 to 18 on multifamily.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. All right, next question. So why should someone work with a mortgage broker like C2 versus directly with a lender, with a bank? What are the differences in terms of experience, rates, and then how does somebody know that they're getting the best rate?
Great question. And I just had this conversation with Brandon Landau, who runs my commercial division earlier, and I have the conversation with loan officers at C2 all the time. And really, and this comes from my experience at being in banking and being on the broker side.
Right.
And from a bank perspective, you're really hammering round pegs into square holes all day. You're kind of a one trick pony. You have one credit box and you're trying to figure out how to get, you know, all these different people to fit into one box. And it's just not one size fits all. And as you can, you know, and what we experienced last spring with what happened with banks, the run on banks has left a lot of uncertainty in people's minds on how banks operate and how safe they are and whether they're in the business or out of the business and what they're lending on and what they're looking for. And from a commercial standpoint, they're definitely in and out, more on the outside. From an investment property standpoint, they're definitely after owner user stuff, which I've got a pretty good pulse on, and that's conventional or SBA or whatever that is. And then the residential side, I think, you know, unfortunately, I I banked at First Republic for all the reasons that I really like them. That personal touch, that fact that I run a business with them and I get, you know, I have a personal relationship and a business relationship with them. And when I buy a home, you know, I want to use them. And I bought a home and they were gone, you know, and that's crazy. And what did I do? I used a mortgage broker, and they have a much better pulse on who's in the market, who's out of the market. At C2, we have 100 plus lenders for our, call it 1,000 loan officers to utilize. And these lenders, these wholesale lenders are often either in the market and they have a bucket to fill and they're very competitive. And all of a sudden our loan officers can kind of, you know, direct business to that bucket because they have borrowers or buyers that are in need. And that's the most competitive lending source in the market. All of a sudden that bucket gets filled. Well, guess what? Somebody that just kind of sold off their secondary, on their secondary, they've got an empty bucket. So it's constantly rotating through a cycle of lenders who are competitive, extremely efficient, and looking for the business. And only a mortgage broker is going to be able to assess that in that moment in time, whether you're buying today or you're looking tomorrow.
Interesting. Okay. So I want to make one quick point, and that is that if you have a loan with a bank that fails, it's not like you are going to have to pay it off. You know, that loan to you is a liability. It's an asset to someone else, and it will get bought by someone else. And the interest rate that you have, the payments that you have, those things will just keep going. It's not like you're not going to have to pay your loan or not like you're going to have to pay it off, right? So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. That makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a client of Chase Bank by default.
There you go. So Chase bought your note and now you owe Chase.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I really want to point out, because I know that there's like, you know, interest rate chasers and people trying to save every single nickel on a mortgage. When I was going through all my little refinance, like tycoon or my cyclone of like refinance, I was a really easy borrower. I had two incomes. I was W-2, perfect credit score, really affordable house for what I was in, tons of equity built up in the home. I went on bankrate.com. I don't even know if that thing exists anymore. And it was like Priceline for finding the cheapest rate. It really didn't matter who I banked. I wasn't in a hurry. Like it just sort of didn't matter. Now my circumstances have changed despite the fact that I've amassed tons of assets and I have a lot of net worth. I also am very complicated now, right? So like work with the person who's going to best suit your needs. And, you know, a mortgage broker can be highly lucrative in that. I only work with certain mortgage brokers now. I can't just go on Bankrate and look for the lowest rate. Like I have to go to somebody who understands who I am and that I have a gazillion tax returns and I own a business and all that stuff. So, you know, match up kind of the complexity of who you are with the person that you're trying to hire, because that will really help, I think, the process a lot and save you a lot of stress. So,
yeah. Absolutely. Great point. And, you know, working with, you know, mortgage broker that has the acumen, that has the, you know, so, you know, whether it's a personal understanding, a business understanding, but also has the resources, you know, sure, you could be working with somebody that fully understands your credit, you know, your credit profile, all your tax returns. But if they can't do something because they're at one shop, they call the golden handcuffs, then what can you do? You got to go to somebody that understands the nuances of your business and your financial profile, but has the ability to go execute with the best lender for you in that market. So completely agree.
Yeah, this is, again, just having, you know, building your team as you become more sophisticated as an investor and just building your financial acumen, you inevitably end up with a team around you. And this is just another person on that team. So you may have found someone who told you a story about how they got this amazing loan directly from a bank. But, you know, David, as you alluded to, pounding round pegs into square holes, it's like that person just happened to meet exactly what those bank's criteria were, right? Which right. is not going to be the same from one person to another, depending on your financial situation. So anyway, what's the difference between a pre-qualification and a pre-approval? If you're looking out for a home right now, which one do you want?
Well, a pre-approval is something that's a bit more fleshed out. You've provided financials to a loan officer. They've ran a full pull on credit, so you're pre-approved, and they can determine what you can buy, what you can afford. A pre-qual is kind of just kind of high level. And we have this conversation on our side of the fence all the time because our loan officers want to be able to issue a pre-approval because realtors and sellers are, you know, they're teed up. They understand that this person is pre-approved versus pre-qualified. Somebody that's pre-approved is going to be much further down the line with a lending source, with a mortgage broker, with a bank versus somebody that's just pre-qualified. Oh yeah, I make this much. This is my credit score. Okay, you can qualify for something like that. Sure. You know, they're just going to be a little bit further down the road. And in a competitive environment when, you know, there's a lot, there's not a lot of inventory with a high demand, you want to have your best foot forward. And that's having a pre-qualification, but also working with a mortgage broker that has the ability to execute really quickly. I got a loan done in 12 days. I mean, wow. We're going to have to change TRID because how quickly things are moving on the wholesale side. I mean, we're going to beat, you know, we can close deals faster than regulations would even allow, you know, where that's just amazing. Definitely not the case with the bank. That's going to be a bit more archaic. You know, they're like dinosaurs compared to where we are, you know, how things operate on the wholesale side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What are some of the things that people need to remember during that process? So if you're shopping for a home, you got your pre-approval. What are some things that some common mistakes that buyers make that might blow up their pre-approval or make their loan more complicated?
Well, it's, you know, everybody wants a deal. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm definitely a fan of getting a deal on everything. You know, I can have a tendency to grind a bit on all, you know, just so I, you know, and if I didn't ask, then I wouldn't know for sure. But I think there is a component, there is a certainty of close component that I think is important to address because sure, maybe you could have shaved off a few basis points if you went somewhere else, went to that bank that took 30, 60 days. But guess what? That rate, you gave that rate, but you would lost that house. You know what right. I mean? So it really comes down to having the ability to execute, obviously getting something very competitive in that trust. It's stressful. You know, these are big decisions. This is something that, you know, can get emotional, specifically a home, you know, somebody that's maybe expecting a child and they're like, hey, we need to move out of our apartment. We need a house that has an extra room for a nursery. Cause you know, there's a lot of different things that happen that can affect people's decision-making ability and how they're going to react. And you want to have that person that you trust that you know can execute, that you know is going to get you a good deal. They're going to relieve some of those stress factors, which is contingency period, getting your financing contingency removed or whatever that is. If there's a way that you can kind of get out ahead of that stuff, so you're like, oh my gosh, our money is going to go hard if we don't, you know, then in kind of circumventing all that, I think that's important because it is a big decision and there are stress related and there's sellers that want to turn up the volume and really put people, you know, stick it to, you know, I've seen things happen where there's unnecessary stressors that can be put in place to make somebody really move when they're unsure and they could have been working with somebody that could have been on front of it. So that's where you get when you work with an expert, you know, like yeah. that we talked about earlier. Like I might not have known that in my first couple of deals, but you know, I've been in this business for a long time. We got people that have been in this business at our company for a long time. They know how you get that with that expertise.
Yeah. I like that.
I have a little off script question here. I've never like as simply as you possibly can describe it to me. You know, the federal funds rate is the rate at which the banks borrow money, right? That's the overnight rate. That's the interest rate we hear about in the news. Like the Fed raised actually 28 minutes ago. I just got the alert. It went up a quarter point.
As expected. Yeah,
bummer. Okay. Anyway, that was totally expected. So it went up a quarter point. So this is a great example. So I think the federal funds rate right now is like 5.5. Is that what it is? Does anybody know? Let's just
mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at 5.25.
5.25. Let's just say it's 5.5 now. Mm-hmm. How the heck does like but if you go for a mortgage rate, right, it might be lower than that, might be higher than that, might depend on number of things. Like how can somebody like where how does that tie to the federal funds rate for home mortgages? Like if I was just going getting a regular primary resident Fannie Freddie back loan, how would that rate be determined? Or how does the wizards that make those rates come out be determined?
Yeah, the gremlins on the other end of the curtain in over on Wall Street. That was already baked in. They already knew that was happening. I mean, the market has already assessed that there's going to be a raise in the Fed funds rate. It's already been baked into the market. You know, you watch CNBC in the morning, they pretty much had already accounted for it. Generally, mortgages are based off the 10-year treasury. That's generally where things are. And then there's a spread over that. So it's usually borrowing at, you know, a lot of commercial mortgages, residential mortgages, they're going to look at that. And the 10-year treasury is going to be much lower than that Fed funds rate. That Fed funds rate is like a prime rate, which is often what's tied to how banks will lend on lines of credit. You know, they'll do, okay, we're prime plus one or prime minus one, ideally. So you see that. And so that is, you know, obviously a factor, and that a lot of times banks and or lenders, specifically depository banks, they have an internal cost of funds. They have what it costs for them to have money on their balance sheet, you know, whether they're paying, you know, they haven't paid anything for a long period of time, but generally if they're paying interest for deposits, they have to factor that in. Plus they have to factor in the cost of putting a loan on the books. So they have an internal cost of funds. So it's usually like when I was in commercial banking, we would look at the 10-year treasury and we put on like 170 basis points. And that was the spread that the bank needed to make over the 10-year treasury, but they're not borrowing that money. In the event they did, that's how they would look at it. That would be their cost of capital if they didn't have a depository, you know, they didn't have depository relationships.
Yeah. So right now I'm Googling the 10-year treasury. It says it's 3.861%, just changed in real time here. So you're going to put a 1.5% spread or addition to that rate to drive your kind of understanding of where mortgage rates would be. Is that right?
Okay. Right. There's a spread over that. So that's the cost. That's just the cost of capital for like a 10-year treasury, like a 10-year T-bill. So that's what a warehouse lender is going to pay. And then they're going to make a spread on that. So their cost of capital plus their spread, they package it up, they fund loans around that, you know, where that market is that day, where rates have fluctuated in the market. And then they, you know, whatever their credit box is, they package it up and they sell that on the secondary market. And that's
so can I like use a car analogy here? So if I go to the dealership and I say, I don't want to pay a dollar over dealer invoice, right? Dealer invoice is basically going to be the 10-year treasury plus 1.5%, which is 5.36%, just real quick math here. And then someone's got to make money. So when you talk about like earlier in the show, you were saying, hey, there's a lot of, you know, shops, mortgage houses that are just piles of cash and they need to like get it out the door. So they're probably going to be selling that inventory for a lower spread over sort of like dealer invoice. Is that accurate or is that not?
It's a supply demand, right? You know, if there's a huge demand, then that truck or whatever that car is going to have a higher, there's going to be a sticker over MSRP because, you know, everybody, you know, dudes want a Ford Raptor. They're going to pay, you know, 15 grand over for it or whatever it is, right?
Leading into like, imagine what's going to happen in like a year when interest rates fall, if they fall, and like everybody's been on the sidelines waiting for these prices to drop and all of a sudden they drop. Everyone's going to come running in at the same time. And guess what's going to happen? They're going to run out of inventory, right? So like those spreads can go really high. It's going to be a heyday for mortgage brokers, right? You know, because refis are going to be through the roof. We all saw this in COVID, right? When interest rates kept going down and down and down and down and everybody just kept refi. It was a crazy time. It's a little light right now. So maybe now is the time to go out and, you know, good hunting, right? Like you can probably find something and the interest rate, like check your balance sheet and make sure you can pay the higher interest rate. But maybe it's not such a bad idea to... Because anytime you have increasing demand, you have increasing prices, right? And so like right now, there's not a huge demand for homes because everybody's sort of like waiting. And if that demand accelerates with lowering of interest rates in the future, you could have a crazy frenzy and end up paying probably more potentially. Not that I'm a huge advocate of go buy a house right now. I'm just saying, you know, give some thought into like where the economics might go and where the indicators are. So anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can afford to buy a home right now, based on where interest rates are at and the price, you know, of a home that is conducive for your lifestyle, then I would say go for it. You know, that's, and then you're going to be in a much better position when rates come down and everybody's in the market. You know, you're going to be refinancing based on where you bought, you know, today versus where you're going to have to buy with rates coming down and the demand being there, which drives the value up, you know, the prices up. So I think affordability is a huge driver, which is why you see a lot more people moving out of California into, you know, decent size, you know, metropolitan areas, you know, places above 200,000 people. I'm not talking anything below that is, I think there's more risk, but anything above that, you're going to, there's a lot of drivers through the Midwest, the East. I'm actually going through a move right now because I bought a place and it was surprisingly when I was picking up a U-Haul, they're like, you're lucky you got this. We haven't been able to have U-Hauls at all. People take them and they drive them and they don't come back. Like everybody's taking them from California elsewhere and they're not here. And so that was like an interesting gauge that I picked up. I'm like, it was kind of a trippy kind of dial or metric or kind of whatever it is, point to look at. For
people. Yeah, you can actually look at U-Haul reports data of like where all the U-Hauls are going. And it's really interesting.
That's actually one of the metrics that we watch as a fund in order to sort of create a macroeconomic thesis on where to buy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's great. I think it's a great, gauge to look at, like, you know, where people are taking these trucks and not coming back from.
Well, David, one question I'd love to ask our guests is, you know, what's something in the past 6 months that just has absolutely blown your mind, changed your way of thinking, something you've learned? That you really haven't shared with anybody, but it's been like, maybe it's a half-baked thought. Maybe it's in the back of your mind and you're just like, you can't really put a pin on it, but it's like a feeling you might have or a new idea. Just anything you're like, man, I can't believe this, or sorry, I'm rambling to give you some time to think about.
Yeah, no, I think that we are very blessed to live in a country and a society that has an incredible opportunity to work hard, to earn money, and to put it to work. And I think that regardless of market conditions, we are always going to be in a place, we're safe for the most part. We've got good neighbors to the north, good neighbors to the south. We've got a big body of water to the west and the east. And I think, you know, real estate here in America is always going to have great value. I think it's where you want to live, what you're comfortable with, you know. And I think that there's always opportunity in every market. I think an interesting thing over the past 6 months was that recent bank run, considering where I banked and, you know, the run on. And I think that social media has the ability to create widespread panic so easily, where it was, you know, way different back in the day. You know, people had to pick up a newspaper to see something happen yesterday or call or get on a rotary dial phone to hear from somebody. And now it's like somebody can just post something and boom, it's like millions of people can see it. They go to a bank, they rip out all their deposits, and all of a sudden, you know, we've got a situation. I did learn that it's really interesting to me how leveraged banks can be. For every, you know, dollar they have, they can lend 10. I thought that was really interesting, that leverage, that was, you know, and so it's interesting, I think, looking at a bank's balance sheet and seeing what bank operators are conservative is good to know. But I don't believe that having five main banks in our country is the best for our economy. That really the underlying fabric of our economy is small business. And those small businesses are helped operate by local banks, local credit unions. And you have to have faith in that. You have to have faith in those business bankers, in those personal bankers. Because if we're stuck with five, I think we're going to be in a world of hurt, you know, along with.
I mean, I get laughed out of the room, you know. I mean, I barely can open up a bank account efficiently with JP Morgan. I mean, it takes like 3 weeks or something, right? So I hear you. And, you know, local banks are killing for us to open up deposit relationships. I love that last statement. I mean, that is definitely a concern. I have to ask though, you have a surfboard behind you. It looks like that's what it is. With dollar taped to it. What's the story there?
The dollar's glassed in.
Oh, cool.
Actually, it's a McCallum surfboard. It's a local shaper. I grew up surfing. My first class of the day was Surf PE up in Encinitas, where I'm actually moving back to. So kind of getting back to my roots. But yeah, I've got a couple boards around my office. I think it's a good vibe. It suits kind of my personality and the overall culture of the company.
What do you guys have, like a mission, vision, values? What's your mission statement or your focus as a company?
You know, I believe that every rooftop that a C2 loan officer touches, they're going to improve the lives underneath that roof. And the more places and people that we can help across the nation, I think the more value we can drive to communities and homeowners. I believe in that American dream, which is now kind of a universal dream, but I think pride of home ownership is a very powerful opportunity, and it allows people to, you know, to go to sleep and rest their head and get up and add a lot of value to where they live and the community around them. And if we can help people achieve that, then that's really our mission.
Awesome.
That's incredible.
Tate, you want to take us home?
Yeah. So we're going to have you back on to talk about residential and second home and investment loans and things like that. But for now, we'll bring this thing home and let the audience know how they can get in touch with you or engage your services. Because I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that are looking to buy homes, second homes, investment properties, all the above.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was amazing being on with you guys, and there's so much to cover. I loved all your questions, and I feel like we only got through half of them.
Sorry. Right, my fault.
But C2, it's all good. It's all good. Yeah, so our website is www.c2financial.com. And on that, you'll be able to find, you know, our platform for forward mortgages, reverse mortgages, commercial mortgages, and we do some sales in California. We have division leaders and really, you know, savvy individuals that work at our firm that can help. And I am always available. You'll see my, you know, contact information on there. It can be found on LinkedIn, social media. My social media, my Instagram is really just kind of my personal life connected with my business. They're kind of one and the same. How I live is a derivative of how I run our business.
That's great.
And that's really our culture here. So our people are cool. They're approachable. They're extremely savvy. And if you're in the market to buy a home or invest in property, I'd highly suggest using an expert at C2.
Well, I can vouch for that. We'll link to that in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us, David. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, David.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tate. Thank you, Ryan.
Take care.